This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, December 24, 2003. From Pacific Station KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Deepa Fernandez. Today we have a special documentary presentation on the private prison industry and how it impacts African Americans, Latinos, and immigrant communities. Please stay with us. The private prison industry is currently the largest and continually expanding U.S. industry. In addition to local and state governments, a large number of corporations and individuals profit from the industry. The Department of Justice, more than ever influenced by a free market economy, has allowed the enactments of laws that allow the mass roundups of immigrants. The Anti-Terrorist Acts of 1996, signed by President Clinton, was followed by Bush's enactment of the Patriot Act in 2001 after the 9/11 attacks. FSRN Simba Russo brings us this special documentary, Voices of African American, Latino, and Various Immigrants Who've Fallen Victim to the Present-Day Market of Prison Profits and Cheap Labor.
Other political prisoners from the Black Panther Party, other political organizations began to realize, especially as a result of the work that we were doing with George Jackson, that the prison system as a whole served as a weapon of political repression, racist repression, affecting not only those who were incarcerated for explicitly political reasons, but the majority of the people who were there, who virtually all of whom were poor. I mean, how many rich people are there in prison? A few here and there. And there still are those sort of country club prisons reserved for them. But the vast majority of people are poor people. And a disproportionate number of those poor people were and continue to be people of color, people of African descent, Latinos, Native Americans.
First major crime that I did, big time, was for robberies. And that was due to drugs. I, to support my habit, I had to do robberies. Imagine if your life was like a hurricane forever. Imagine you
locked down forever. The jaws stand a weather. You built for that weather. Alfredo Perez is a 50-year-old ex-inmate who spent over 20 years in the prison system. I met Alfredo on Crosby and Spring in Lower Manhattan, New York, asking for money for food. Alfredo is a victim of America's social policy of mass incarceration. Currently, there are more than 2 million Americans behind bars. This number has more than doubled in the past 10 years.
My sentence was 7.5 to 15 years. I did almost 8 years out of that, out of the 7.5 to 15, and did the rest out on the streets on parole. I completed it, but it's still the same thing, coming back out without an education, without doing anything to better myself in the prison system. When you first leave them doors, you only leave with $40 in your pocket. You don't have nothing to go by. You don't have no place to go. And you got to start your whole life over after 8 years. You got to start your whole life over again with $40 in your pocket. The prison system, they get so much money, supposedly to be helping a lot of the inmates, that they say they spend over $28,000 to $38,000 per inmate. When it would be, that kind of money would be better spent by helping individuals over here in the street with these so-called organizations to help a lot of people, whether it's homelessness or people coming out of prisons, ex-offenders or whatever. They should be more geared to giving them a job. Say they give them $12,000 a year. Give them a job for $12,000 a year. Bring down you got a lot of empty buildings around the city that could be geared for this year, and give them low rents.
Incarceration has remained the main form of punishment to control crime in the United States for the past 30 years. Instead of offering rehabilitation, drug treatment, or community service, lawmakers are adjusting criminal policies to allow for lengthy prison sentences and to ensure increased incarceration numbers. Most American citizens incarcerated in this country are from communities of color, predominantly African Americans and Latinos.
Although it's comfortable nest egg, it doesn't even begin to scratch the surface to the suffering my family and I endured for those years that I was incarcerated. Being incarcerated for this particular crime is sheer hell, okay? You're treated like scum.
Alberto Ramos served more than 7 years in prison after being wrongfully convicted in 1984 of raping a 5-year-old girl at a daycare center. He was released in 1992 after the court found that the trial prosecutor had withheld evidence that would have exonerated him.
Each and every day of my life behind bars, I had to fight or be abused physically, sexually, by correction officers, administrators, and fellow convicts. I mean, there was actually no one to turn to. I was incarcerated for those years, and endlessly I remember trying to convince anyone that would listen that I was innocent, okay? No one wanted to hear it, because as far as the system was concerned, I went through the system, I was found guilty by a trial, therefore I was guilty.
Mattis got one strike hard rock on me and pulled a razor. I caught him before he caught me. Because he wants to make me act like a criminal. I ain't here because I'm a criminal. I'm here because I'm poor. That's why I'm here. For a toothbrush.
African Americans account for only 12% of the United States population, but 44% of all prisoners in the United States are black. This rise is due to the war on drugs, which accounts for more than 22% of those in federal and state prison. Most individuals charged with a crime are poor and cannot afford to obtain proper legal representation and end up with court-appointed lawyers. Investigation claims and motions are not filed or experts hired to properly represent their clients. Many inmates are wrongfully convicted because of society's fear of young black and Hispanic men, causing unfair trials to be deemed as justice.
The hunt is on for black or Latinos in the system, and even those poor whites. Those who are disenfranchised, who don't have the means to defend themselves and have people monitor their civil rights and human rights, will become victims of the system. It's been proven time and time again, and it's been proven to me especially that if you don't have the right resources or you don't know the right people and they see that you are powerless in this country, you will become a statistic for the system. Whether you're innocent or guilty, you will suffer within this system. And the only way you can change that is if you empower yourself by trying to get these resources and these contacts to make an opening for you to get out the system. And it's not easy for anybody that's been wrongly convicted to prove their innocence because of the way the system is set up.
Aaron Patterson spent 17 years on death row in Illinois after he was wrongfully convicted in a 1986 murder of an elderly couple. He was pardoned this past January as part of Illinois Governor George Ryan's clearing of death row. Now 39, he has announced that he is running in the Democratic primary in March for a seat in the Illinois State House.
Segregation is being alienated from the rest of the population on death row or in prison. And segregation, you are subject to wear leg shackles everywhere you go. You're handcuffed. You're not allowed to make personal phone calls. You can only call your attorney 3 times a week. No contact visits whatsoever. The visits are 1 hour each, 2 times a month. You are not allowed to buy any type of food from the commissary. You're placed into a 6-by-9-foot cell that has a steel door. You don't have bars. You have steel doors. And you're subject to verbal and physical abuse by the guards. Most of the guards and administration where I was located in Central Illinois and Pontiac, as well as Southern Illinois and Menard Correctional Facility, were avowed racists. I didn't even know the Ku Klux Klan or the Aryan Brotherhood was in Central or Southern Illinois.
Rap is on, you know what I'm saying? Doing it live and direct, live and direct. More prison, you know what I'm saying? We need no more, baby. Can walk through the streets, politic all night, start to make our own.
More than 3,000 suspected terrorists have been arrested in many countries.
Violence breeds violence, repression breeds retaliation, and only a cleansing of our whole society can remove this sickness from our souls.
I'm going to continue to say it to America. The nation in which we live is the supreme culprit.
And here's the proof.
We have the terrorists on the run. We're keeping them on the run. One by one, the terrorists are learning the meaning of American justice.
And that enemy is the immigrant. It's not accidental, I don't think, that as this rhetoric, this anti-crime rhetoric developed, as the anti-welfare rhetoric developed, an anti-immigrant rhetoric also developed. You know, keep the borders closed, prevent the, and you see, it's interesting, it's not just a question of preventing people from other countries from coming to the U.S. and trying to establish a life here. It's a question of presenting certain kinds of people, people from certain countries, people from third world countries.
Large waves of immigrants are entering the United States, and at the same time, the U.S. is detaining and deporting immigrants in record numbers. Since 9/11, thousands of new citizens are finding themselves behind bars indefinitely across the country. Prior to the 1980s, wide-scale detention was uncommon. The traditional policy was exclusion at the border or deportation of those already crossed the border illegally with release on one's own recognizance. Today, immigrant detention has become one of the fastest-growing sectors of the current jail population in the United States.
Let's go, fellas. Shout time's up in 5 minutes.
Yo, little Khadija pops his lock. She wanna pop the lock. My prison ain't nothing but a private stock. And she be dreaming about his day to release. She hate the police, but loved by her grandma who hugs and kisses her. Her father's a political prisoner, free Fred. Son of a panther that the government shot dead back in 12-4-1969. 4 o'clock in the morning, it's terrible, but it's fine. Cause Fred Hampton Jr. looks just like him, walks just like him, talks just like him. And it might be frightening the feds and the snitches to see him organize the gang, brothers and sisters, so he had to be framed. Yo, you know how the game go, 18 years because the 5-0 said so. They said he set a fire to an A-Rap store, but he ignited the minds of the young, black, and poor. Behind enemy lines, my niggas are cellmates. Most of the youths never escape the jail fate. Super maximum camps will advance their game plan to keep us in the hands of the man locked up.
After 9-1-1, they think everybody's a terrorist, and they want to go after every immigrant.
And the tactics that the law enforcement agencies are using now is that they'll go into either a place of residence or a business with sort of, you know, with the accusation that somebody there has a minor criminal offense, and they're investigating.
Monami Malik of Desi's Rising Up and Moving.
Usually those charges are something like credit card fraud or marriage fraud. Then on that pretense, they'll go in there and they'll round up 15 to 20 people. Because most likely it'll be an immigrant business or an immigrant household.
In 2000, I pleaded guilty according to my attorney's advice, and I was sentenced to 7.5 months to Rikers Island.
Namu Shihani is 64 years old and has been a green card holder for more than 20 years. Now Mr. Shihani is facing deportation to India for charges he says are unjust.
But before sentencing me, the judge told the prosecutor that there seems to be a legitimate business people. He should not be sentenced to jail, even for a day. And I have the minutes of the judge, which I can prove it that judge said that. But the prosecutor, he said then he will give it to the federal government, and then I may have to face 20 years jail, which I got scared.
Like African Americans and Latinos, immigrant detention has increased due to new legislations. The Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996 and the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigration Responsibility Act of 1996 expanded the number of crimes for which non-citizens can lose their legal status and be deported. Before 1996, deportation was limited to crimes of rape, murder, and other serious felonies.
There was another 129 people on the plane. There was only 22 people in that same prison just they took with me. They took so many people from two or three different states, which nobody has a knowledge where they're going to take them. In there were husbands, children, you know, eight old people, you know, they're leaving behind everything, just taking their pants, clothes, and that's it, whatever they have on them, you know. And, you know, by just deporting one person doesn't mean nobody's going to get affected. You just basically paralyzing the whole family.
Faisal Ulvi was released a day before Christmas last year after spending 2 months in detention and being placed on the plane for deportation. On November 8, 2002, he was arrested at his home for alleged arrest warrants from 1995. Although Mr. Ulvi is married to an American citizen, the INS claimed it was not legitimate.
At that point, I only had a concept of that INS detainees are supposed to be separate than local prisoners or local charges or whatever, how you know, the local way. Because we're just detainees, we're not criminals. So at that point, I was thinking that they was going to take me to a local private housing like they usually used to do it. But when I saw they took me to the Middlesex County and they put me to the beginning cells like every other average criminal regarding whatever charges they brought you in, and they kept us all together and stood over there for like 6 days. The seventh day they took me to the, to the housing unit where all immigrants were at the end. But I only stood over there for 24 hours. But it was very uncomfortable because, first of all, I didn't do nothing wrong. I didn't have no criminal charges or criminal records. I don't know. To me, it was so uncomfortable because the surrounding was so much effective. There was a lot of different people, a lot of criminal charges around me, you know. And God knows what I was going to pull out. And I didn't want to get into more trouble that I was already in because after Liz spoke to me and she told me, you know, make sure, you know, you don't do nothing that can affect you in the future. So it was just so horrible. I can't even start explaining you what was going through my mind when I was around those people.
When people show up, a lot of them are not quite clear on what they're supposed to do, but they're trying to abide by the law and the regulations of the INS. So they show up to register. If they don't have the right papers, if they're missing certain papers, if they're overdue on their visa regulation, and they call it a visa violation, then they're getting detained.
The INS contracts out to local jails, municipal jails, and private prisons the care, custody, and control of over 60% of its detainees. In 1994, the INS had custody of 5,500 people. And by 1997, while the number of federal and state inmates was declining, the number of INS detainees rose to 16,000. By 2001, the INS was detaining an average of 19,500 immigrants on any given day.
Thugs, the real thugs, it's the government. Don't matter if you're independent, Democrat, or Republican. Niggas politic in the street, get in the beef, start blasting. Now a new cat is executive chief. With a passion for heat, you get blast in your seat. Die before you crash in your Jeep. Never passing in your sleep like an old man. You ain't a fool, you got a whole plan. And conquer territories like Europeans who stole land.
Governors receive the largest amount of money simply because gubernatorial campaigns cost a whole lot more than do Senate or House campaigns. And also the amount of power in one person's hand is disproportionate. Governors can make decisions. They're the final bill signers.
Edwin Bender is a political analyst for Free the Money.
In the case I'm thinking of North Carolina, where you had the private prisons industry, which was hoping to site a couple of new prisons, supported one candidate really big early on. When he lost, or it became apparent he was going to lose, the private prisons industry turned around and put a whole bunch of money into the campaign of the winner, help him pay off his debt. There's a larger amount of power concentrated in the hands of one person who can help move the private prison industry agenda. So they realize they need to put money in that hand to see that their agenda is passed. Also, the amount that gubernatorial candidates raise is much higher, and so the amounts of money they're going to get are going to be larger. But they are still only one piece of the political, strategic political process. They still have to have support in the legislatures, in the Senate, and the House, as well as with the governor.
The private prison industry has ridden on the wave of unprecedented expansion in the scale of imprisonment in the United States. The major players, Cornell Corrections of America, or CCA, and Wackenhut, have managed to save their industry from bankruptcy. With the collapse of rural communities and a lack of jobs to maintain a living wage, set the stage for the push for prison construction as a cure for rural growth industry. Through political campaign contributions and deployment of the best lobbyists making modern-day prisons in the interest of the stockholders' profits, rather than to increase public safety, improve prison conditions, or to rehabilitate the prisoners.
Well, I think in the first study I talk about Arizona as a really good example of the complete picture. The private prison companies expanding across the country picked out the states where they wanted to pursue an agenda. They supported lawmakers with campaign contributions, seeing that they got elected. In the process, they had a seat on the American Legislative Exchange Council's Criminal Justice Task Force, which drafted industry-friendly legislation, whether it was for privatization, for import of out-of-state prisoners, for mandatory minimums, for three strikes. That cookie-cutter legislation, I like to call it, was funneled through the American Legislative Exchange Council from these industry-backed committees through ALEC to its members, who are sitting state legislators, representatives, and senators. Those senators would then come to a conference, an ALEC conference, where the task force would present their ideas, present what they viewed as a problem and potential solutions, and they hand out notebooks, you know, 4-inch thick notebooks of cookie cutter legislation on everything from health care to criminal justice. In the case of Arizona, one of the leaders of ALEC was a senator from Arizona. She went back to Arizona and proposed the private prisons legislation that had been drafted by CCA and the bail bondsman. This, against the recommendation of her own corrections department, which said they did not need private prisons. What they needed to do would be expand the state facilities and use their money more efficiently and do sentencing reform. She pushed that and was ultimately successful in getting a private prison in her state over the objections of her own, of the state's criminal or corrections department recommendations. And, you know, she received money from CCA. She was a member of ALEC. She carried ALEC's legislation, which was written by the industry. So that was the best example that I have in the study of how one legislator was able to, was serving in a key positions of power both in the American Legislative Exchange Council and in the state, Arizona State Senate, was able to carry a piece of legislation, industry legislation, all the way down and see that it became law.
With a budget of $615 million, the INS contracts more than 20,000 beds to state, local, and private facilities. For example, in Passaic County Jail in New Jersey, where a number of INS detainees have been held since 9/11, received a $30 million contract to house detainees.
Well, the bulk of it stays in the local system. This funding pays for new patrol cars for the sheriff's department, added staff in the sheriff's department, sort of a larger jail for the sheriff's department.
Political analyst Judy Green.
In addition, states may take a cut. So that, for example, in Virginia, where some 30 local jails house prisoners for the INS, in the year 2000, those jails raked in $22 million. The counties kept the bulk of the money, but Virginia has a federal grant reimbursement fund at the state level, and so the state got its cut too.
people from Central America, people from Asia. I read a study that indicated that actually the largest number of illegal, quote, illegal immigrants come from European countries. But no one ever considers the possibility that a white person could be an illegal. I mean, I know quite a number of illegal people, you know, from places like Britain and France, who come in on student visas and decide to stay. And they don't even feel threatened. I mean, it's interesting. They are not even afraid of the INS. Whereas people who are, quote, legal citizens, but who look as if they might come from another country, fear what the INS might do to them, or that if they don't have their ID with them, that they might get deported. So isn't it interesting that in all three of these examples that I've given, the figures are clearly racialized figures. And I think that there's a structural connection between the demonization of the immigrant and the criminalization of populations of color in this country. And let me give you just a sense of how I would try to make those connections. I said I might say a few words about capitalism, or did I?
Substance of content.
Have you ever felt like you were just a modern day slave, living in a life worth living only some of the days, working hard nights, hard strikes from all types, no rights but pardons, we live within the system, starving is determined.
This special presentation of the Prison Industrial Complex was produced in New York by Simba Rousseau, with a special shout out to all the voices that continue to struggle against incarceration.
Is not the fault if we don't try and reprimand it. We define the dotted line with these niggas speaking slander.
I start my verse by Saint Julian, and if you got a problem, kid, you know just where to find.
This special FSRN documentary, The Private Prison Industry in America Today, was presented by FSRN's Simba Rousseau. Please tune in tomorrow for another special FSRN documentary presentation as our reporters remember a year of reporting for Free Speech Radio News. In Berkeley, I'm Deepa Fernandez.
That's right, I'm up here, and I'ma keep on getting louder until somebody out there listens. With no pot to listen.
The way I say.